your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, October 9th, 2025. As we record this episode, the MLB postseason is getting dramatic. Congratulations to the Toronto Blue Jays as they beat the New York Yankees in four games to reach the American League Championship Series. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. went 9-for-17 with three home runs against the Yankees in this series. Mercy. Aaron Judge, he had himself a good postseason despite the Yankees getting knocked out as he finished hitting .500 with a .581 on base percentage. Also, congratulations to the Los Angeles Dodgers that won in the most insane way possible to beat the Phillies in four games. In this episode, we'll get caught up on the postseason as Ball Go Far, Team Go Far still reign supreme in the postseason, even though the percentage of runs scored this postseason from home runs is down. But we are going to talk more about power in baseball with our guest, Travis Sawchick. He's the author of The MVP Machine and Big Data Baseball. He wrote a feature story on Driveline Baseball about how power ages for Major League Baseball hitters. Jim Margulis is away on a much-needed vacation, and I assume James Fegan is trying hard not to hurt himself as he's getting prepared for the Chicago Marathon this upcoming weekend. You can follow James through the Chicago Marathon app, which you can download through the Apple App Store or the Google Play if you have an Android device. His bib number is 64670. Again, that's 64670. Track James. And good luck, James. You got this, bud. It's just 26 miles. Starting with recapping the MLB postseason to date, the Toronto Blue Jays beat the Yankees in four games, winning 3 out of 4. The Blue Jays scored 34 runs in four games. As a team, the Blue Jays hit .338 with a .373 on base percentage, and they slugged .601. And to make things worse for the Yankees, with runners in scoring position, the Blue Jays as a team hit .341, and they hit 9 home runs in the series. Add it all up, the Yankees had a tough time pitching. After only allowing 6 runs in the 3-game series against the Boston Red Sox in the wildcard round, to give up 34 in the next 4 games is pretty embarrassing, which, adding to the frustration, is how the Yankees couldn't take advantage of Judge's hot bat. If Aaron Judge is batting .500, you should be scoring some runs. The Yankees did put up 19 runs in 4 games, which isn't bad, but clearly not good enough to overcome the pitching. I'm curious how the Yankees approach this offseason. Gerrit Cole is hoping to return from his 14-month-long rehab in mid-May of 2026, but it's now 16 years and counting since the Yankees last won a World Series. The Bronx is getting impatient. Meanwhile, the Blue Jays returned to the American League Championship Series for the first time since 2016, when they lost back-to-back championship series, in 2015 to the Kansas City Royals in 6 games, and in 2016 to the Cleveland Guardians. The Blue Jays await the winner of Seattle and Detroit. Tarik Skubal will start for the Tigers in Game 5, and Seattle did have good results against Skubal this season. In 2 starts against Seattle, Skubal didn't get past the 6th inning as he allowed 7 earned runs in 10 and 2/3 innings against the Mariners. Jorge Polanco has 3 career home runs against Skubal, so something to watch for. Seattle's projected starter is George Kirby, but Luis Castillo is also available to help piggyback. It could be a tense pitcher's duel in Seattle, which makes for great drama. First pitch is at 7:08 p.m. Central Time on Fox. Over in the National League, a night after the Dodgers let Clayton Kershaw die on the mound as the Phillies scored 5 runs in the 8th inning against the future Hall of Famer, in Game 4, the two teams were locked in a classic pitcher's duel. Phillies starter Christopher Sanchez went 6 1/3 innings, allowing just 1 earned run on 5 hits with 5 strikeouts, while the Dodgers starter Tyler Glasnow pitched 6 scoreless innings with 8 strikeouts. Both teams scored a run late as it went into extra innings. Roki Sasaki was awesome out of the bullpen for the Dodgers and now has become an unexpected weapon this postseason. Sasaki pitched 3 scoreless innings on just 36 pitches. But with the bases loaded and with 2 outs, Phillies pitcher Orion Kerkerian got Andy Páez to hit a weak comebacker. But instead of going to first base, he airmailed a throw to home plate. resulting in the game-winning run to score. That's how the Dodgers win the NLDS against Philadelphia and move on to the National League Championship Series. Meanwhile, over at Wrigley Field, Ian Happ's three-run homer once again provided fireworks for the Chicago Cubs in the first inning. What's fascinating in this series is that the Cubs have scored in the first inning of each game. They've already produced 11 first-inning runs through four games. Milwaukee needs to work on their first-inning plan for Game 5, and it's going to Game 5 thanks to good pitching from Matthew Boyd and the Chicago Cubs bullpen. They forced that Game 5 as Milwaukee couldn't generate any offense in the cool Chicago weather. Game 5 will be in Milwaukee Saturday night starting at 7:08 p.m. Central Time on TBS. There have been two baseball analysis features I've enjoyed this past week. The first came from J.J. Cooper over at Baseball America, analyzing MLB pitch data and the importance of velocity and how it plays a factor, not only in racking up strikeouts, but also preventing extra base hits and, to a certain extent, innings workload. The second is about how power ages from Travis Sawchuk over at Driveline Baseball. His feature got me wondering about the White Sox, especially with the power outburst we saw from Colson Montgomery. Is that type of power for real, or was it fluky? Also, how can we identify other hitting prospects for the White Sox who can help in the power department? Joining me now to talk about how power ages is the author of this study from Driveline Baseball, and he's also written a few books as well, The MVP Machine and Big Data Baseball. It's Travis Sawchuk. Travis, thanks for joining the Sox Machine podcast.
It's great to be with you, Josh. Thanks for having me.
So what I found fascinating about this study, because from a White Sox perspective, here's Colson Montgomery. He joins the team, really struggled in AAA. With the torpedo bat in hand, he hits 21 homers in 77 games. And I'm wondering, is this real? And what should we expect moving forward? But when I was going through your study, I was really surprised on how quickly it seems like power just disappears and vanishes for a lot of players, maybe with the exception of some of the outliers that we'll talk about. But you found in your data analysis, Travis, that once a player hits age 26, it starts to decline. For our podcast listeners that haven't checked out the study yet, what did you find that happens after age 26 for major leaguers?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I'm sure anyone who's listened to a baseball telecast or just followed the game, you'll hear times that power improves with age as players develop maturity and their man strength, however you want to describe it. And, you know, I was curious. I've heard that a lot. I was curious, is that true? So, you know, being at Driveline, we have some good data scientists, some great data scientists there. And I just asked them, could we test some underlying power measures from bat speed, exit velocity, max exit velocity, air pull percentage, swing decisions? Could we look at all this stuff and see what? Because my hypothesis was some things probably aged well and some didn't. And, you know, as we went through this, it was kind of interesting that almost nothing aged well. That players, you know, when they reach, and just some background on the study, it covers all the Statcast era. And we just looked at players who had seen 1,000 pitches in a season and how they changed season over season. So you had to see at least 1,000 pitches in a season to have that season qualified. And we were looking at year over year changes for individuals and combining all that. So it's a snapshot of the last decade. And that's important because it's a decade of where players have had launch angle data, exit velocity data. So they had this understanding, they could train for it, incorporate it into their preparation, how they played. So, but even in this modern era, with all this knowledge, what we saw was that, you know, physical, what we think of a physical prime is earlier than probably what we think of it as. It's not late 20s, it's mid 20s. It's by the time you're 26, almost every underlying power skill is declining, from bat speed to max exit, to average exit velocity. Even swing decisions don't really improve much. They're pretty stable over time. They don't fall off a cliff in a player's early 30s, but there's not even that much improvement then. It's kind of a stable skill that slightly improves. The only exception was air pull percentage. And we can get more into the detail. You can take this where you want to, of course, Josh, but that's the one thing that did improve with time. It seems that players develop an understanding of maybe what pitches they can, they're better at hunting pitches, they're better at waiting for pitches to get in their nitro zones, best places to do damage. So that was one skill that did improve. So it's sort of interesting. You know, when players debut at 22, many of them have as good a physical skill, or 23, 24, they're at their peak physical ability. Now, whether they have, I do think game experience and some other things play into air pull percentage, but yeah, power doesn't really improve with age. It's it peaks earlier than one might expect. The other interesting insight is, okay, now that we know this, can players train for this better? Will the age curve look different going forward? As we go a decade out from now, there's a new training regimen. So I'm talking way too much. I'll stop there. But that's kind of the general overview of what we found.
So I want to talk about like the early age. Like you mentioned, you're at your physical peak at 22, 23. I mentioned Colson Montgomery. He's currently 23 years old. He'll be 24 next season for the White Sox. And reading this, my initial thought was, oh my gosh, Travis, they have all screwed up. They as MLB front offices. Why were you playing with service time, guys? If you knew this, MLB front offices, you should have been calling all these players up when they're 21, 22 years old. You should have not been waiting around service time to really take advantage of peak physical ability of a particular player, especially during their rookie contract years when they're getting paid league minimum pre-arbitration. And this notion that I've had for years, now I'm like really sold, Travis. Have MLB front offices screwed up? Should they be calling up their young position players now to take advantage of their physical peakness?
It's a great question. And if you do believe, like, the average debut age is 25 years old in baseball. Now,
and it based on this data, it seems like it's too late.
That's a takeaway that I would have. And, you know, superstar players generally debut earlier because they force hands, their production. Mm-hmm. So there are some outliers, and there's definitely some survivorship bias in a study like this where the best players, you know, altered curves, whatnot. But generally speaking, yeah, if the average debut age is like 25.3 years, that's already in a player's physical smack dab in their physical prime. So you're debuting at your peak and it's almost just declined from there. Ideally, the debut age would be earlier, you know, 22, 23, and you capture the entire incline. And even though the decline is more subtle in 20s, you capture all the best parts of physical maturity and underlying capabilities. And I do think teams are waiting too long. And part of that is just the economics that we know of the game due to the rules of the CBA. I'm also curious, like, this is a bit of a tangent, but as player development improves, as, you know, things like the traject become more commonplace, even in amateur trading, we're going to see players more major league ready earlier too. So maybe we can see some pushback just from players being not just the physical capability, but more quality reps earlier too. So yeah, I do think teams are waiting too long. I understand they want to, you know, they're trying to squeeze as much value out of players as they can, and they don't want players to develop at the major league level. But you're debuting at your physical peak and you're just declining from there, and that doesn't really make sense, you know, when you zoom out.
Right. And it even like from a draft perspective or international signing perspective, because the White Sox have completely overhauled their international efforts. They're already targeting kids that are currently 12 years old in the Dominican Republic and committing $6 million to them, even though technically they can't sign into 2030. But that does make sense. Like for the White Sox, they have been more focused in recent drafts to draft younger players. They just drafted back-to-back high schoolers. Caleb Bonnemer, one of their best prospects in their system right now, is a high school pick, because you can get these 18 and 19-year-olds and you develop, and you think on average it takes 2 to 3 years in the minor leagues to develop. Well, there you go, Josh. From a White Sox perspective, Caleb Bonnemer, when he joins the majors, even Colson Montgomery, they're 22, 23. We could take advantage 3-4 years of this prime. But if you're drafting someone out of college, Travis, I was thinking, especially from the SEC schools, they got to go right? Because they're already 21 years old. They have to hit the ground running so you can get as much of those prime years as possible. I'm thinking they get a season, maybe a season and a half before they reach the majors if you really want to take advantage of the power.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, you want to take the best players, right? You don't want to overthink it to where you're not taking the best prospect available. But macro level, again, I do think you want to target younger prospects who are generally going to have more upside too. If you believe in your developmental staff processes, you know, you should want them in your system longer too when they're teenagers. And then you enjoy all their peak. You know, Montgomery, 22, his bat speed's already elite. But it's hard to improve that with age if you're already focused on that. So you want to capture all of that. I mean, even like, you know, we think of Juan Soto as he debuted very early, 19, I think. But you look at his, you know, first full season in the majors from a efficiency WRC plus perspective, they're not any real different than what he's done the last 2 years. He's been, there's some trade-offs in skill, but he's been an awesome player since he debuted. Great players are generally great very soon after they're in major league. Ken Griffey Jr., Mike Trout, maybe after an initial struggle, you're pretty awesome if you're going to be awesome. So the idea of delaying and I also think about this age, college, high school, or younger international. I think about Adley Rutschman with the Orioles. We thought about him as his first years were awesome in the majors. Like, oh, this is going to be a long-term building block for the Orioles. But it's almost like he reached the majors at 24, he was maxed out with what he could do physically. And we've seen some bat speed decline from him. We've seen some underlying deterioration. And he's only, what is he, 27 years old? 27. So even at 27, some players already beginning decline, which advanced college players. To your point, I think you have to be careful when you're targeting them. I think a study like this, you know, each player is his own specific case, but again, in a large sample level, if you're taking advanced college players, they need to be up soon because the clock is already ticking on their underlying physical capabilities.
So when it comes to power and in this study, I was really curious about bat speed because, again, Colson Montgomery podcast listeners averaged 77 miles per hour with his bat speed. Do we have enough data now, Travis, that there is a direct correlation in bat speed and power?
Oh, sure. There's definitely a relationship there. You want bat speed. It's some interesting things we found is that the best outcomes come from a hitter when he's swinging at 90% of his maximum bat speed. So there's some control power trade-off there. But you still want the underlying ability. You want to raise the tide as much as you can, right? You want your 90% to still be above average in terms of what that number is. So yeah, there's a strong relationship between power and bat speed. It's not the only thing that matters, but if you're going to be an elite power hitter, you generally have to have it. And bat speed helps batting average and all these underlying things too. It creates margin for error in addition to a batted ball traveling faster is going to go further and have higher expected run values. So yeah, it's you still have to make contact, but bat speed is critically important. And at Driveline, it's one of the foundational things we work on with everyone. And there are cases where older players who have not done bat speed training, like Nolan Arenado a few years ago, he did have a late career improvement because he did come into Driveline for the first time after talking to Joey Votto about his late career bump. And he did have a following season where he improved his exit velocities, bat speed, and he had a much better year. He's had a couple down years since then, but Nolan's coming back in this offseason to work on it again. Mookie Betts is another guy who, amazing career. He's always looking for a way to get better, something to improve. And he's another late career guy who adopted bat speed training. So it's not that older players can't do this, but it is a trait that declines immediately if you're not training it. Age 22 in our study, top bat speed, and it's just downhill from there. So without focus on that, without training that, it's a skill that does not improve at all with age. Another tangent, it'll be interesting the next 10 years as bat speed training becomes, as it proliferates through the game more, Will the aging curve look different for these skills? I suppose if everyone did the same training, there would still be this curve where you would still benefit by being younger. But the hypothesis with some of the coaches and trainers at Driveline is there wouldn't be as dramatic a decline in a player's 30s as there is today. So that's another interesting consideration. But yeah, someone like Montgomery, it's a really important tool to have. And, you know, he's an exciting player because of that underlying trait in addition to his other skills.
And I wonder if that's also why the White Sox can't quit Luis Robert, Travis, is because he does have elite bat speed. Like, he still has it.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, the top stars in the game are not swinging slow bats generally. Aaron Judge, Schwarber, all the great rookie with the A's, Nick Kurtz, these guys are swinging the bat well above average, you know, most of the top power hitters. So there's only the outliers like a Jose Ramirez in Cleveland, who's become a master of the air pull skill. Unless you do that exceptionally well, you have to have bat speed, and you can build from there. You can learn to improve contact point and do other things. So yeah, I wouldn't give up on anyone unless ownership was making me that had an underlying trait like that, because it's the equivalent to pitching velocity, right? Like, yes, you can get away. You could have excellent command or this wider arsenal of really good secondary pitches, but if you don't have the velocity to compete in the zone and win in the zone with a fastball, then it's really hard. It reduces your margin for error. So it's not the be all end all, but it's an important underlying skill.
Now, you mentioned Kyle Schwarber. Podcast listeners, Travis and I are recording this segment a day after Schwarber hit two home runs in game three of the NLDS against the Dodgers. And it seems like Schwarber, to your point, is a bit of an outlier when you're looking at this type of data. He had 56 home runs this season at age 32. Schwarber's a free agent. He'll be 33 next year. And based on this age model, it's supposed to suggest that Schwarber's bat speed should slow down, power should decrease. Again, Schwarber could be the outlier amongst all these free agents, but a lot of position player free agents these days, Travis, are older than 30 years old. If teams know about this and they start buying into this aging model, isn't this really going to hurt the upcoming free agent markets for players that are older than 30 years old? Because there are questions about if the bat speed will hold up.
Yeah, it's another, there's a few ways to look at it. On one hand, it's another mark against older players. If teams are already aware of this, it's going to reinforce the idea that we don't want to sign aging corner players or bat first players, right? And we've already seen the market work against a lot of these players in recent years. Even Pete Alonso had to settle for a 2-year deal to return to the Mets. And maybe he could have gotten three elsewhere, but it goes to show how teams have really devalued that kind of player who's in his 30s. Schwarber is an outlier because he's maintained a really high level of bat speed and exit velocities later in his career. But even with his case, you know, teams are going to be hesitant, I think, to give him an extended deal. Short term, sure. Extended, I don't know how large the bidding pool will be. The one thing, though, working in Schwarber's favor, I think, if I was making a case for him, is look at he's always crushed the ball, right? Even since his debut, he's always had great underlying bat speed, power. But his last 3 years, he's become an elite air pull percentage player. The last three seasons, highest air pull percentage marks of his career. This season is his highest. And when you combine that with his underlying elite bat speed and exit velocities, you know, you get this player pushing 60 home runs in a season. And I do think that is a skill that ages well. He's a smart player, clearly. He understands the strike zone. He's made subtle adjustments throughout his career to improve. So just knowing that shows a certain baseball intellect, IQ, a skill that has appeared on the field, I'd be a little more comfortable buying into that, just knowing that he's been able to evolve and that probably will age well. So he does have that in his favor, and the air pull percentage is something that can help players improve their efficiency later in their careers. At least until like ballparks are made symmetrically, where down the line distances are the same as center field, you know. But because baseball parks are built, dimensions are strange, where it's shorter down the line than the center, there's a great advantage in pulling the ball in the air. And still, it's not optimized. I mean, not everyone is doing it. Not everyone can do it. But Schwarber improved his contact point. It's two inches out and further out in front of the plate this year than the previous year, which is a pretty sizable jump and speaks to a pretty smart baseball player.
Well, in your study, you mentioned from 2025 to 2015, there's a 66% increase in pulled air fly balls than a decade ago. So this isn't just a few players. This seems to be a concentrated effort throughout Major League Baseball. And I know others have written about this particular topic. It is going to be interesting going into next year. And this is something that I mentioned because for our podcast listeners, I can already hear you guys starting to argue with me that you don't like necessarily like the exit velocity. You need a balanced lineup. Yes, you still need some power hitters, but not everyone needs to go out and be a power hitter. Yet again, we're watching the postseason and ball go far, team go far, Travis. And when you play your home games at Wrigley Field, even Steve Stone has been harping on this for years. You got to build a lineup that's conducive to your home ballpark. And no matter how the White Sox will try, Wrigley Field is never going to be a pitcher's ballpark. So they need guys to put the ball in the air. And I'm wondering if this needs to be a concentrated effort moving forward, especially with all of us analyzing our baseball teams. Is air pull percentage going to be the new secret sauce to determine if a team has true power potential and if they have more opportunities to score runs?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly be a focus of mine if I was employed by a team. I would want, not that every player can do this or not every player's skill set, like Luis Arraez, you would not want him trying to do this, right? There's certain profiles where you want to be more all fields. You do not want elevated launch angles. But if you go watch Major League batting practice, most guys have lots of power. So and the way to tap into that is fly balls in the air to the poolside. And that's not a secret anymore, but it's still not optimized, I don't think. Even though we've seen that 66% increase, fly balls are still pretty evenly distributed for the most part in Major League Baseball. And I do think teams, while certain individual players have optimized training and at Driveline, we preach this all the time. I don't know that every organization's done a great job in really bringing out that skill as best as they can in players. Some have, some have not. But I do think, especially at a place like Wrigley Field, you don't want to hit ground balls. You don't want to hit line drives up the middle. You want to take advantage of the dimension, how the park plays. And you think about the postseason where strikeout rates are even more elevated, it's hard to string three hits together. The best teams, because of that, pit for power. It's the three-pointer of baseball. And it's not going back in the tube unless there's some major changes in how the game is played. But until Major League Baseball would intervene in some way, it's a cheat code. And I know some traditionally minded fans push back on this, but I mean, I have to say Ted Williams and Babe Ruth were all about this too. It's not like it's something the best power hitters have always done. It's just that we can measure it now, train it better because we have a quantifiable feedback loop. There's really not much new in baseball. The only thing that's changed is that we can scale things and teach them better because we have a tech feedback loop and we have more information. So anytime I hear an anti-analytics rant, I just replace analytics with information. Are you anti-information? Of course you're not. We want information. The more information you have, the better you can make decisions. And no, not every player fits in a certain archetype, but most players can do this. Jose Ramirez can do this with average exit velocities. There's a lot to, there's still a lot on the table for teams to take advantage in this space.
No, this is good. Because the White Sox will be hiring a new hitting coach. So I wonder if this is something that is of mind. How can we help more of the hitters start blowing the ball in the air? Miguel Vargas is a is a prime opportunity candidate. Kyle Teal as well for the White Sox. Can they get more home runs outside of just Colson Montgomery and, fingers crossed, Luis Robert? But I do want to end with Colson Montgomery. After this data, and again, I use him as the focal point because going to next year, I think the expectations might be a little too high. I mean, that's what you get for hitting 21 homers in 77 games. But from what you have seen, Travis, and looking at the aging model, when you have someone like Colson Montgomery entering his second season, was this a fluke, or does his type of power have staying power in the majors?
No, I don't think it's a fluke at all. I think he, with that underlying bat speed, and he's not a ground ball guy. He's going to get the ball in the air. And in that ballpark, he's going to be a 30 home run threat as long as he's healthy. And he's an exciting building block. I think there's some, can he get that strikeout rate down a little bit? There's some things that can come with maybe some different training regimens, and just there's no substitute for major league game experience either. Just more of that under his belt will allow him to reach another level. But what an encouraging, debut. And I do think the White Sox have a lot of really promising position players, Teal, other guys in the pipeline coming together. The other Montgomery,
Braden Montgomery, yeah,
a lot of Montgomerys coming through that are very exciting. So that's exciting. So if you can, I don't know how much overhaul has to be done with the coaching, but get some slight efficiency improvement through coaching this group, that's pretty exciting. The pitching side, I think, is a little, some of the underlying issues, strike throwing, walk rate. I mean, there's some work that needs to be done, but I am pretty. When I look at this position player group and what's coming on paper, it's pretty exciting.
Well, that is good to hear. As White Sox fans are done watching 100 lost seasons, if you haven't gotten a chance, I've included the link on SoxMachine.com so you can read Travis's full study on how power and its aging for major leaguers over the past decade. You can follow Travis. He's on Twitter. He's at Travis_Sawchick and read his excellent work now on DrivelineBaseball.com. Travis, this was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer my questions about how power ages in Major League Baseball.
Thanks for being interested in the subject. I was. So I think, other folks will find it interesting too. And, let's see these younger players up earlier in their careers, because they're not aging like fine wine. You want them fresh.
That will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. If you do check out our videos, please hit the subscribe button over on our YouTube channel. You could also follow us on social media. We're on all the social media outlets at Sox Machine. You can follow our beat reporter, James Fegan, at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you are on Instagram, we're trying to grow our audience over there. Please follow us over at Sox Machine on Instagram. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com/products. Monthly plans start at $5, and that gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website and unlocks the comment section for you. We also have additional tiers of support that give you additional benefits, such as a monthly Zoom call and an opportunity to join our Veterans Committee, which gives you direct access via our group chat to both Jim and James. Great for the off-season, especially with any whispers and gossip that we are hearing when it comes to the MLB off-season. Again, if you're interested, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.